From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The striking image out of Iraq today is of U.S. Special Forces piling truckloads of machine guns into the arms of Iraqi exiles flown back for a piece of the war and a role in the peace to follow. Tonight on Point, Iraqi exiles, homegrown leaders, and the battle over the next Iraqi leadership after Saddam. We begin with a military roundup and look ahead. U.S. forces appear to tighten their grip on Baghdad today, with tanks moving widely through the city and American air power everywhere in the sky. I spoke with Major Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies, and asked him for his assessment of the situation in Baghdad.
What we can say for certain is that at some stage, Baghdad is going to fall to U.S. forces. Now, the question is, how many days is that going to take? Now, I made an assessment on day two of the war, where I said 14 days to Baghdad and about 14 days to control Baghdad. I think it's going to take less than 14 days to control Baghdad, but it will probably take at least a week. And there's some pretty hard fighting going on in various areas of the city. It seems to have died down tonight, as far as we can make out, but we expect it to break out again at first light tomorrow morning.
But the U.S. progress has been very steady. On the other hand, not all good news. A U.S. tank fired into the Palestine Hotel today, killing two cameramen, wounding three journalists. What's your assessment? Is this reasonable? Is this in the heat of an attack on a city? Is it irresponsible? Is it possibly even deliberate?
Well, I think we can rule out deliberate straight away. I don't believe that's true. Once again, we're in this wretched fog of war where you get two accounts, two totally different accounts from both sides.
But is it that foggy? I mean, wouldn't U.S. military in that area know the purpose of this hotel?
Well, they may not have even known what the target actually was. They would have probably seen a large building. They would probably suspect there was some shooting coming from it or the vicinity of it. And they would have put a round or a missile in that general direction to basically to keep people's heads down. One of the things when you're involved in urban fighting is one of the amazing things is that you have to fire to keep people's heads down. When there are shots coming towards you, you have to try and win the firefight. You may not actually be firing at targets that you can see.
Just keep the fire pouring on.
You keep the fire pouring down, and then you hope that the fire will die down a bit and that you can get to do what you want to do.
A sad outcome of that today, but I guess then any number of Iraqi civilians have fallen in the same firing zone. On the other hand, it has led to a fairly rapid envelopment of the capital city.
Well, from a coalition point of view, the worry is that we're going to see a very large number of civilian casualties. Now, there is no doubt whatsoever that coalition forces are actually storming the city now. They're going straight into the city and they're fighting their way through. And we're going to see a lot more of this as the days go by. And we have to be prepared, I'm afraid, for a very large number of civilian casualties and all of the political ramifications that are going to spring from that.
Is there no way to avoid that, given what appears to be fairly overwhelming American power?
Tom, it's too late. It's already happening.
It's happening. And the evidence is there
in
the hospitals.
If you listen to what's happening in the hospitals.
And we do.
And we're getting it off the Middle East stations as well, who've got people in that area.
Yeah.
It's happening. And obviously the government in London and Washington, those governments are going to have to come up with some convincing explanation of why this had to happen.
Big question today on the airstrike attempt to kill Saddam Hussein. What are you hearing on that front?
Well, British security sources are saying that they think, in fact, that Saddam Hussein got away, that he left that area literally minutes before that airstrike went in. Again, no one knows for certain. We've got claim and counterclaim. If Saddam Hussein can make some sort of announcement over the next few days, and then we'll probably believe he's still alive. There is no doubt that the removal of Saddam Hussein, the death of Saddam Hussein, will really shake the opposition, and a lot of the Ba'ath Party members who are fighting will probably want to lay down their arms.
But regardless, the relative, and I say relative, ease with which American troops have marched into Baghdad does seem to raise issues about who's in charge and the Iraqi command structure.
It raises certainly the issue of who's in charge. It raises the issue of the Iraqi command structure. We think that's broken down and that everything that's happening now is pretty uncoordinated. It certainly raises the issue of Iraqi military incompetence. And it raises a number of other issues as well, such as if you train and equip along old Soviet lines, you are doomed. All sorts of interesting things for the military analysts to chew over for the next couple of years. There is no doubt whatsoever that the Russian command, control, military system that many countries have adopted is a failed system, and I can see a lot of people dumping it very, very quickly.
From Syria to Pyongyang, anything new to report on the possible chemical weapons front at all?
Well, we've heard nothing at all. We've been logging all the various reports of chemical weapons. There are so many of them. It's actually quite astonishing when you start looking at them.
From coalition forces?
All coming from coalition sources of one sort or another. Not necessarily coalition forces. We don't think this is misinformation. We think it's just purely the fact that people keep coming across various powders and various suspicious items.
Barrels here and boxes there. And
they have to be treated with caution. And they have to go off for analysis. All of that takes time. And we certainly haven't seen any credible evidence of weapons of mass destruction yet.
So U.S. troops, U.S.-led troops enveloping Baghdad, still more fighting to go there, obviously. But what's next? What's the end game now, militarily?
We're not there with the end game yet. I mean, coalition forces have to go into every single town, and at the end of the day, every single village.
Will they have to fight their way into northern cities, the oil region, Mosul, Kirkuk?
Well, they're going to have to fight their way into some of these cities, some of the much bigger cities. Well, but once the government in Baghdad goes, and it's quite obvious to everyone in Iraq that there is no longer a functioning government in Baghdad, it will, of course, discourage some of the people in the other cities, certainly Mosul and Kirkuk. Now, in some cases, there will be fighting, but in the majority of cases, of course, there won't be fighting. It will just be removal and rounding up of the Ba'ath Party hierarchy who are causing problems. But that's going to be quite a long job. It's going to take quite a lot of troops. Again, the estimate there was it would probably take about 2 months to sort that out. It would be foolish to think that this is all going to end overnight. There is going to be a sort of mass surrender of one sort, or a surrender ceremony on a U.S. battleship drawn up in the Gulf, you know, a la Japan. It's not going to be wrapped up all that easily. And certainly the pacification phase will go on, certainly, I think, until the end of May, up to mid-June. And we're going to require troops in Iraq, lots of them, for a long time to come to support this new government.
Charles Heyman, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. He spoke with us from Shrewsbury, England. On Sunday, U.S. military forces airlifted Ahmed Jalabi, the leader of the Pentagon's exile group of choice, the Iraqi National Congress, into southern Iraq. Today, they armed Jalabi's exile vanguard. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, based in Tehran, has sent a different brigade of exile fighters into northern Iraq. And homegrown Iraqi leaders, after years under Saddam's repressive rule, will surely soon emerge as well. Throw into the mix the conflicting visions for Iraq of the U.S., Britain, and the U.N., and warring visions even within Washington, and you have the ingredients for some wild post-war power plays. Tonight, we're looking at the next Iraqi leadership and asking who should, who can come after Saddam Hussein, an exile, a homegrown leader, and how does the outside world help mount a new leadership without creating a weak puppet regime? Joining me tonight from Washington is Patrick Clawson, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and Senior Editor of the Middle East Quarterly. Good evening and welcome, Patrick Clawson.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Also joining us from Bronxville, New York, is Fawaz Jerjes, Chair of Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College and author of America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures or Clash of Interests. Good evening and welcome, Fawaz Jerjes.
Thank you.
Fawaz Jerjes, what is shaping up here? It's hard to read this. We've got Pentagon-backed Iraqi National Congress troops now. They're armed behind Ahmed Jalabi in southern Iraq. We hear of Iranian-backed exiles coming in from the north. Surely some homegrown Iraqi leaders will emerge as Saddam is pushed aside as well. What is shaping up here? Do we have a kind of battle already for the leadership after Saddam?
Well, absolutely. As you know, there has been a great deal of infighting among the exiled Iraqi opposition for the last a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think despite everything that they have done, I think they're still, they have a long way to go. And I think there is no particular person either inside Iraq or outside Iraq who commands a broad political support in the country, including Ahmad Shalabi. Although the Defense Department and the Office of the Vice President, Dick Cheney, have been promoting Ahmad Shalabi as a potential leader, I think he does not have the political weight, a large political following, and hardly any social base whatsoever inside Iraq. And I think the big point is the following. I think it's crucial that Iraqis inside the country, along with exiled opposition groups, meet, consult, and decide on a collective formula to govern, Iraq after the fighting is over. And I think for any emerging government to function, to be effective, to be seen as legitimate, I think the process of consultation and representation must be transparent and fair. Otherwise, I think we're going to witness a great deal of turmoil and social upheaval and infighting, not just among the exiled opposition groups, but also between them and some other factions inside Iraq itself.
Patrick Claussen, can you imagine, are there potential leaders within Iraq, given how long Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party has been in power, who might emerge as contenders to actually lead the country post-war? Or in your view, does it have to be an exile at this point?
Well, we are optimistic that we're going to be able to find some people inside the country who have the kind of cachet with Iraqis that Mr. Gerges was talking about. But we frankly don't have an idea yet. We don't have a clue. And certainly some of the exiles among the 2 to 3 million Iraqis who live abroad are charismatic people who may well turn out to have much more support at home than we think. The United States government has spent much of the last year trying to court many of these different individuals. And some of them are very impressive people, like Mr. Chalabi, but also some who to date are not working with us, like a former foreign minister of Iraq, Adnan Pachachi.
Why so much fire around Ahmad Chalabi? Hasn't lived in Iraq for 45 years, from a prominent banking family, left in 1958 when the monarchy fell in Iraq. Seems to be, and you can perhaps tell us why, very much a figure of choice in the Pentagon, but stoutly opposed elsewhere, stoutly opposed by the State Department. Reportedly, there's a CIA report out saying that he does not and will not have support among Iraqis inside Iraq. Why so much attention on this man, Patrick Claussen?
Well, he's a very charismatic individual, and as you mentioned, he comes from a wealthy family. He's devoted a lot of his wealth and a lot of time over the last 12 years to promoting the cause of an Iraq which is pro-Western in orientation. I think there are a lot of people in the State Department and in the CIA whose conception of Iraq is very much that of the past, in which they think about people by their ethnic or religious identification, and someone who is determinedly a modern secular person like Ahmad Chalabi.
Though he is a Shiite by family legacy.
Correct, but he is also someone who very much wants to see Iraq ruled by people who are selected not on the basis of their religion or of their ethnic group. And there are many in the CIA and the State Department whose idea of how to put together a new Iraq is to engage in some politically correct process of making sure that you have the right number of people from tribes, the right number of ayatollahs in the Shia community, and who would basically cut out of this process the modern, secular-oriented urban professionals that Ahmed and his group represent.
Fawaz, we just have a minute before the break, but what do you make of that? Do you see the CIA as backward-looking, the Pentagon as the modernist here?
No, not at all. I think the larger point is the following. I think the United States should not be in the business. The United States should not be in the business of installing either an Iraqi potential leader or even a U.S. commander. I think at the end of the day, Iraqis themselves inside the country, along with Iraqi opposition group, should be the ones to decide the future of their country.
Do you think the U.S. is getting into the business of installing right now?
Absolutely. It seems to me that both the Defense Department and I think the Office of Dick Cheney and other members of what I call the ideologues in Washington are pushing Ahmad Chalabi, very hard. And here the question is not just Ahmad Chalabi is a secular person. Ahmad Chalabi does not have a large political following.
Fawaz, just hold the thought. We've got to take a short break here. We'll come right back and look at that. We're talking about the next Iraqi leadership tonight, homegrown exiles, and the U.S.-UN battle for the future there. How do we get to Iraq's next generation leaders? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the next Iraqi leadership, about homegrowns, exiles, and the U.S.-UN battle for the future that's flitting around all of this. You can join the conversation. Who should, who can come after Saddam Hussein? Can Iraqi exiles lead an Iraq they have not lived in for years? Can you imagine that a tier of potential untainted leaders may have survived inside Saddam Hussein's Iraq? What will it take to make a new Iraqi leadership credible to Iraqis? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight and pleased to be by Fawaz Jerjes, Chair of Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College, and from Washington by Patrick Clausen, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And
may I complete my point?
Oh, yes, please, Fawaz Jerjes.
The point I was trying to make, Tom, is that I don't think the State Department and the CIA and some members of the Congress object to Ahmad Chalabi because he's secular, he's modern, he's naturally traditional and conventional. The truth is that he does not have a solid social base in Iraq itself.
So why so much support?
Because, after all, I would argue that neither the Defense Department nor the ideologues have basically a little appreciation of the complex realities in Iraq. And as I think, as my colleague said, he is charismatic. He appeals to the ideologues in Washington.
Why?
He tells them exactly what they want to hear. He's willing to accept their premise about, future Iraq. But the realities on the ground in Iraq are very complex.
But wouldn't it be a fiasco for the Pentagon and for ideologues, as you call them, in Washington, if Chalabi was put in and didn't work out?
Absolutely.
Don't they have an awfully lot at stake here as well?
Absolutely. And here, Tom, the question is not about, this is not a question about semantics here. The idea of installing either a U.S. military commander or even an Iraqi ruler is not sensible because it's fraught with danger. It would send the wrong signal, not just to Iraqis and Arabs, but to the world community at large. And also it would reinforce widely held perception that the United States is determined or aims to control Iraqi resources.
So you're saying hand this off to the UN. Is that your bottom line?
No, the leader of the largest Shiite opposition in Iraq, Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, has made it very clear that the Shiite community, which represents over 60% of the Iraqi population, would not accept either a U.S. military commander or even an imposed Iraqi ruler. In fact, he threatened.
May I jump in on that?
Patrick Clausen and Fawaz Jerjes, I want to ask you both to stand by for just a second. We're going to come straight to this, but I want to hear what Donald Rumsfeld had to say yesterday. This is on the record at the Pentagon yesterday afternoon, the Secretary of Defense giving his view of where this move toward new leadership will go.
Clearly, the United States is not going to impose a government on Iraq. It's going to be something of a kind with Afghanistan. It may not be called a lawyer jurgit, and it won't be. But at some moment, the people from inside Iraq who now are in a position, they're not in a position today to speak. They're still controlled in some parts of that country by the regime of Saddam Hussein. Those people need a voice at the table. The people from the areas that have been liberated need a voice at the table. The people from outside may want a voice at the table. And that process, I couldn't even, anyone who tells you that they know, that they have a mental picture, a cookie mold that they think is going to get pressed down on that, are the kinds of people who were talking about the war plan having never read it. It is not possible to know that because how it will evolve will depend on what the Iraqi people decide.
So there we are, Donald Rumsfeld speaking yesterday. Patrick Clausen, I know you're chomping at the bit to get back in. What's going on here? Does the Pentagon, we know they want to put Jay Garner, the American general, in charge for a transitional period. Do you believe they already have, despite what Rumsfeld says, a chosen guy, Chalabi, to lead this country going forward or not?
Nonsense. And in fact, Fawaz gave the game away when he referred to a prominent Ayatollah as the man who's the leader of the Shia community. It's ridiculously old-fashioned conception to think that most Shia in Iraq follow slavishly some religious leaders. They don't. And that, in fact, secular-minded urban professional Shias are not going to regard some backward Ayatollah as the man who speaks for them.
Well, they did in Iran for quite a while.
And they don't now. We know that today the Iranians don't, that the Iranian people don't regard these people as those who speak for them. And we have no reason to accept that the claim of some Ayatollah who's based in Iran, who hasn't been in Iraq for many decades, to say that he speaks for the Shia community. And it is precisely the people in the State Department and in academia who think of Iraq in these old-fashioned terms of, oh, if they're Shia, they must be following Ayatollahs, who find repulsive the idea that a democratically minded person like Mr. Chalabi, who wants to cooperate with other people on the basis of their ideas and not on the basis of their religious and so and ethnic background, they find that this quite repellent.
But can he command the kind of visceral loyalty of Iraqis that will make him credible to this country?
I hear
in your description of him a kind of foregone conclusion that he will be
no,
the guy.
Good gosh, no. We don't know. And let's not prejudge the conclusions. The State Department has worked might and main to try to rig an Iraqi opposition coalition to only include the people from these traditional backgrounds. And it is the Defense Department which has fought hard to say, no, look, let's wait and see. Let's wait and see, as Mr. Rumsfeld was saying, who the Iraqis themselves turn to.
We've allowed a variety of people back into the country.
What we've done is we refuse to block Mr. Chalabi.
More than that, he was flown in on American planes, and we all saw the rifles loaded into his vanguard's arms. I mean, maybe that's the right thing.
Hardly the only group. For instance, there's a group in Najaf of domestically grown people who we have been arming for the last few days, and who in the streets of Najaf are the ones that we are working with.
Okay, Fawaz, I want to hear from you, Fawaz, if this isn't your view, what would you like to see happen here?
What I would like to see happen is that, as I said, really, if we have a basic concern, is that Iraq is, and I know I'm reiterating the same point, that Iraq is themselves. I would be delighted if what the Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, made it very clear that it's up to Iraqis themselves inside the country, along with exiled Iraqi opposition groups. I mean, exiled Iraqi opposition groups should have a decisive role to play. After all, they are fighters for a free Iraq. But, I mean, the larger point I would like to make is that there's a great deal of confusion over the Bush administration's plan to run Iraq in the immediate aftermath of fighting.
Why?
Here you have General Garner, saying that he wants to leave Iraq within 90 days. Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense, made it very clear over the weekend the U.S. military would be in control of Iraq, he said, for more than 6 months. Ahmad Chalabi himself said that he would like the U.S. military to remain in Iraq for at least 2 years. What this tells us, Tom, is that the administration has invested little time in or thinking about plans to run post Saddam Hussein. And I think it seems to me there's a great deal of fighting among U.S. officials, not to mention, of course, the splits with the international community. And I think this confusion, these tensions are not reassuring at all for plans to run Iraq in the immediate aftermath after fighting.
Well, they're certainly very evident. Fawaz Yerzeyas, Patrick Claussen, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Houston, Texas tonight, Dr. Mahdi Albassam. He's a founding member of the Iraqi National Congress, that is the group headed by Ahmed Chalabi. He's a member of the board of advisors of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Mahdi Albassam.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening. You hear the kind of split-screen view of what lies ahead here and whether or not an exile like Mr. Chalabi is an appropriate potential leader for Iraq. What's your view? Is the INC a bunch of exiles who don't really have a base of support inside of Iraq and will be imposed by the United States? Or are they good candidates to take the country forward?
Well, let me start by trying to correct some of the facts that were misstated in the previous conversation. We must understand that the majority of Iraqis are secular, and they are not necessarily led by religious leaders, such as the Ayatollah Baqir al-Hakim. Additionally,
fair enough, secular, but they do have associations, Sunni, Shia, Kurdish, and so on.
But they do not emulate Ayatollah Baqir al-Hakim. In addition, we do have other Ayatollahs who are in Iraq, who have been in Iraq, and some that have come back again after the war has started, that are clearly older and more considered much more the source of emulation for Shias than the ones that are coming from Iran or hopefully will be coming from Iran.
Mahdi Al-Bassam, can you imagine Ahmed Chalabi as the next leader of Iraq?
Yes, sir, I can, and I think that the entire concept of having the indigenous people that have remained under control of Saddam Hussein to come up with a rapid leadership from within themselves that excludes the Ba'ath Party, which is a necessity for Iraq to go forward, that concept is not well-founded.
You think there's just no one left who could lead the country after those years of Saddam Hussein's rule? Is that what you're saying inside?
He has pretty much wiped out the entire indigenous opposition that is under his control. The only areas where you have experience with democracy and you have chances of people that have had experience are the ones in the north of Iraq, which has been under the no-fly zone, the Kurdish zone, and additionally the exiles who have been to countries in the west. And these are the people who are coming back to help their own people try to build a democracy in Iraq.
Patrick Clausen, is your view of Iraqis who have lived under Saddam equally bleak? Is there no one in their number who might emerge as a potential leader? Are they too beaten up and maybe already assassinated?
Well, I'm a perpetual optimist, so I'm hoping that some of the army generals, for instance, and also some of the university professors and other figures in Iraqi society are going to emerge as natural leaders who command some support. But we'll only find that out with time. We'll only find out over a period of some months whether or not that there are Iraqis like that that we can turn to.
How would you give credibility to an exile leader who's coming back like Ahmed Chalabi after 48 years? It's a long time outside the country. We know he's been in the north, but still, how does an exile like that end up with the credibility in the eyes of the Iraqis to lead the nation?
Well, for one thing, because the 15% of Iraqis who live in the Kurdish areas in the north, that is to say the areas outside of Saddam's control, when they formed this broad coalition, Iraqi National Congress that represents all the different opposition groups, that 15% of the Iraqis live in the north, their democratically elected government wanted Mr. Chalabi to play an important role. That suggests that he does have some important support within the country. And what we have to do is find out over the next few months and few years whether or not he or other Iraqis are the ones who the people of Iraq would like to turn to for running the new government.
Fawaz Shirzeh, is there another plan afoot? It seems like a fairly strong push. This Iraqi National Congress leader has been flown in. He's there. He has armed followers inside Iraq. He's holding court in Nasiriyah, receiving delegations. Does this have so much momentum that it's just going to happen?
No, I don't think so, unless the United States, arms twists, many Iraqis, and in particular, even among Iraqi opposition groups, as you know, there is a great deal of infighting. Let me say, Tom, a few words about Iraq. Despite Saddam Hussein's tyranny, and despite his really crushing civil society, by the late 1970s, Iraq had one of the largest middle class in the Arab world. Iraq had one of the most advanced educational and technological systems. Its women were some of the freest in the Arab world. And yes, Iraqi civil society is dormant. But yet, the challenge now is how to revive Iraqi middle class and civil society. And there are some great talents inside Iraq. And when we say that Ahmed Chalabi does not really have a solid social base, we're not suggesting that we should dismiss Ahmed Chalabi. All we're suggesting is that Iraqis, all Iraqis, inside the country, along with Iraqi opposition groups, should meet, consult, and determine on the most effective means for mechanisms and institutions to govern their country. All we're saying is that the United States should not be in the business of either installing a higher commission over Iraq, or in fact an Iraqi ruler like Ahmed Chalabi or others.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mahdi Al-Bassam, How do you imagine this being resolved? What kind of meeting or, you know, great congregation, loya jirga equivalent, to use terms Americans know from Afghanistan, might be held to come to some conclusion about where leadership should come from?
Well, definitely the way we see it in the Iraqi National Congress, and I feel on the ground in Iraq, is that we should have an interim authority which is Iraqi, that can communicate with the Iraqis and set up the basis for a civil society that will hopefully bring us towards democracy within a very short order. With that in mind, those people who are in the interim setup are going to be able to formulate a constitution. They are going to need to formulate courts for trials for the greater crimes that were committed by the Saddam regime. They are going to have to go and take Iraq through the process of de-Ba'athification, that is similar to denazification of Germany, mm-hmm. where we are going to need to change the institutions in Iraq to where the Ba'ath Party has taken such strong hold on running them. The people in Iraq then would have a constitution to vote on, and from there they would be able to elect their representatives.
And in all this, do you see the Iraqi National Congress coming back from outside seen as saviors or as carpetbaggers?
No, they would be actually saviors and people that will help enhance the process of going towards a democracy. At the end of the day, whoever the Iraqi people will choose would be their leader. And that, I believe, is something everybody in the INC agrees to.
Patrick Clausen, is the United States committed to the kind of process that Mahdi Al-Bassam describes?
Yes, although the United States also knows that it has to start out by having a military government. The United Nations the other day, in passing a resolution about Iraq on March 28th, reminded the United States and the UK that as occupying powers of Iraq, they have heavy duties to provide for a good government in the immediate aftermath of the war. And the United States knows that that's something that it's going to have to do on its own for a while until this process we have been discussing can select a new Iraqi government. So we're going to have to start out with a military government while we go through that kind of consultative process.
And what do you guess? Jay Gardner's 90 days, Paul Wolfowitz's 6 months plus?
Well, Jay Gardner's 90 days for how long he plans to be there. After he leaves and he hopes can hand things over to an interim Iraqi authority, the United States still has to keep its military troops present to help that authority, because that authority is not going to be in a position to guarantee the security in the country for a while. So Gardner hopes he'll only be there for 3 months. He's hoping to hand things over to an interim authority, and the United States will stick around to help that authority for a couple of years.
Patrick Clausen, Fawaz Jirje, stand by. Dr. Mahdi Al-Bassam, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Dr. Mahdi Al-Bassam, joining us from Houston, Texas, is a founding member of the Iraqi National Congress and a member of the Board of Advisors of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq. We're talking this hour about the next Iraqi leadership, homegrowns, exiles, and the U.S.-UN battle that's around all of this. How do we get to Iraqis leading a new Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the next Iraqi leadership. You can join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. 8255, who can come after Saddam Hussein? And why are Pentagon hawks pushing so hard for Ahmed Chalabi? What does Iraq need in a leader now? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Fawaz Jirjes, Chair of Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College, and Patrick Clausen, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Fareed is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Fareed. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Good evening.
I think the whole issue is who is going to choose that interim authority. And I think, and I'm speaking as an Iraqi native, that it will need to incorporate a large element of people from inside Iraq Patrick Clausen is right to note that there is not much that we know about Iraq right now, and that we need to see how things will pan out. But there are certain things we do know, and there's been a very, I think, revealing study that was done by the International Rescue Committee. I don't know if you've spoken of it before.
I don't know of the study, Fareed. What is it?
Well, it's I think, the only study which conducted something like close to a poll in Iraq, polling people in Mosul, in Baghdad, and in Najaf.
Okay.
They came out with three conclusions, the first of which was that people, surprisingly, wanted to get rid of the regime, even at the cost of a war. Mm-hmm. The second conclusion that they came out with was that people really wanted just a sense of normalcy, you know, life, be able to feed their children, to mm-hmm. have their children go to school, to, you know, be paid at the end of the month, and just a sense of normalcy without
all
the isms. And the third thing was a great wariness towards the exiled opposition.
Why do you think that is, Fareed?
Well, look, I left Iraq in the early 70s. I have not lived through the harsh regime of Saddam Hussein. And I just can think of, you know, the reaction that my classmates had. People I really love and respect, and I think they, you know, have the same feelings towards me.
You mean that exiles have been off with the easy life and don't know what it's been like?
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, this is not exclusive to Iraq. I mean, similar feelings are probably felt, you know, by the Afghanis or by the people in Timor.
But aren't you worried, as an Iraqi, that the people inside Iraq have been so beaten down and abused over all these years that it may be hard to produce a leader there, or the opposite?
I have a better opinion of Iraqis than you do, Tom.
Well, I don't mean to be disrespectful.
I'm respectful of their experience. It has been harsh, but. Look at the example of Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and internal oppositions emerged very, very quickly.
After all those
in
years,
Romania.
Fareed, you make great points, and we thank you for calling. Fawaz Yerzes,
we should not underestimate that even though civil society has been crushed, I think it's hibernating under the surface. Tens of thousands of Iraqis died in opposition to this bloody tyranny. So in this particular sense, I think there are many talents in Iraq. And I think the motto should be any arrangement should be as inclusive as possible. Iraqis should be given the right for self-determination. I think this is what should be the motto. We should not try to be in the business of installing not only an American military commander, but even an Iraqi ruler on Iraq today.
Fawaz Yerzes, if this interim period is not put under United Nations authority, isn't it kind of inevitable at some level that the U.S. will be seen as having installed someone?
Absolutely, Tom. And in fact, it seems to me it's in America's own interest, as well as in Iraq's interest, that the arrangement be inclusive, that the world should be involved, that the United Nations, that the European Union, that the Arab states. This is not just to give the United States effort legitimacy, a cover of legitimacy, but also to provide substantive resources to help Iraqis rebuild state and society. But I'm afraid, Tom, again, I refer to the ideologues within the Bush administration. They have little respect and use for the United Nations. In fact, they have made it very clear in the last few days that the U.S. military, not the United Nations, should be in charge of running Iraq. In fact, the United Nations, the U.S., the U.N. role, be limited to humanitarian aspects and not to political and governing aspects. And I think it seems to me that the ideologues appear to have the upper hand so far, but one would hope that Tony Blair that would have some influence on the president in order to involve not just the United Nations, but also the European Union and the world community in playing a substantive role in order to legitimize the U.S. effort and provide critical, vital resources to help Iraqis rebuild, begin the process of healing and rebuild state and society.
But the president is still talking about a limited role for the United Nations. Patrick Clausen, what is it that that the Pentagon sees as so wrong about the United Nations? What's the problem that you and some there fear would emerge from a more multinational, multilateral approach to the rebuilding of Iraq?
Well, we have a lot of powers at the United Nations who are hostile to what the United States has done in Iraq, and will do their best to complicate the United States' life, and would insist that any UN role would be run by the people who are critics of what the United States did in Iraq. And also, the United Nations' efforts to bring democracy around the world have not been particularly successful. You think of Cambodia, for instance, the massive UN effort, which left the place in a shambles. Or you think of the UN-administered processes in Kosovo and Bosnia, which have been indifferent successes at best. And furthermore, the United States has, as the Security Council has been reminding the United States, the United States has the obligation under the Geneva Conventions to provide for a government immediately after the fighting stops. The United Nations has said that once a resolution is passed by the Security Council, it will take at least 90 days before the United Nations can have any presence on the ground. So the U.S. has got to, under the Geneva Conventions, provide the government for that time period.
Patrick Clausen, let me ask you one specific question that seems to be an issue with Ahmed Chalabi, who, as I understand it, favors Iraq recognizing Israel, which would be very helpful in many dimensions to Middle East peace process. But do you believe that an Iraqi government coming out of this whole conflict can take that position? Would that be accepted by the Iraqi people? I have no idea.
Nor do we, but I think it would be surprising if that were to happen, that an interim Iraqi government would have to first get broad legitimacy before it engaged in any kind of dramatic change in Iraq's policies, whether it be policies about oil or policies about Israel. These are delicate political issues, and in fact, as Mr. Chalabi himself has said, that it would be inappropriate for any interim Iraqi government to do something like this.
Down the road, after there's
elections, then Iraqis will have to decide questions that are particularly politically delicate.
Fawaz Sher says there's a big fork in the road here, and it looks as though we're barreling down the Pentagon fork.
You know, I'm surprised to hear that he's talking about that the United Nations and the U.S. military effort as really if the United Nations has empowered the United States to go into Iraq. That in the eyes of the world community, in the eyes of most of the Arabs and Muslims, and in fact Iraqis, this is an illegal invasion of Iraq, and this is why. And this is why I come back to the big point. It's in America's interest as well as in Iraq's interest to involve the United Nations and the world community to minimize the damage, to isolate the political reverberations of the Iraqi crisis. And yes, Tom, I think you asked a very critical question. I think the reason why they love Ahmed Chalabi because he's willing to listen and to tell them exactly what they want to have. And I think this is a recipe for political disaster. This is why I hope that the State Department and other major institutions in the United States would finally have a say in what the future of Iraq would be like in the next few months and next few years.
Wow. Well, it looks like this is going to be some wild road to the next leadership there if we have this kind of deeply divided opinion even within the United States before we get to the region. But I want to thank both of you for joining us tonight. Patrick Clausen in Washington, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Patrick Clausen is Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and Senior Editor of the Middle East Quarterly. And Fawaz Yerges, thank you for your insights tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Fawaz Yerges joins us from Bronxville, New York. He's Chair of Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College, author of America and Political Islam. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. In a reversal of fortune worthy of the stage, the Pulitzer Prize for Drama was awarded yesterday to the little-known 42-year-old Cuban-born playwright Nilo Cruz. Cruz became the first Latino-American to win the drama prize, beating out stalwart playwrights Edward Albee and Richard Greenberg. Cruz's play, Anna in the Tropics, is set in the cigar-rolling factories of Ybor City, Florida, in 1929. This week, On Point will be honoring Pulitzer Prize-winning work. We begin tonight with Nilo Cruz on the origins of Anna in the Tropics.
The genesis of the play is a beautiful tradition that was brought from Cuba to Tampa, and that is a tradition of having a lector, having a reader read to cigar workers while they were rolling their cigars. some of these cigar rollers were illiterate, but they could quote writers like Shakespeare. And when I learned that such a tradition existed, I was fascinated by it. And so the tradition is at the center of this play, and basically is what this reader is reading to these cigar rollers, and in this case it happens to be Anna Karenina by Tolstoy, and it's how this book starts to change the lives of the cigar rollers and how the story of Anna Karenina mirrors their own lives. And this is a scene between the lector, the reader, who comes from Cuba, and a cigar roller named Conchita. The name of the lector is Juan Julian, and the name of the cigar roller is Conchita. And, of course, this takes place at the factory after they've gone out for a walk. I knew a fellow from New London. He was modest and reserved. So shy was this boy that when he expressed any sort of feeling, he would excuse himself. One day I gave him a braid that I cut from my hair and told him to bury it under a tree, and I explained to him that back in the island most women cut their hair once a year on the 2nd of February when plants and trees are pruned for the feast of San Candelaria. I told him how women offer their hair to the earth and the trees for all the greenery and fruits to come, and I gave him my little braid in a box and told him to choose a tree in the park. And the boy looked at me with a strange face and said that he would feel embarrassed digging a hole in the middle of the park in front of everybody. And that's when I took my braid back from him, took a shovel, dug a hole, and put him to shame. From then on, he never talked to me again. So he's the only person from New England that I've met, Juan Julian. And do you still cut your hair every 2nd of February? Conchita, yes. My father always does me the honor of burying it, Juan Julian. Your father? And why not your husband? If I were your husband, I would find an old, wise banyan tree, and I would bury your hair by its roots, and I'm sure it would accept the offering like rainwater, Conchita. Well, I'm cutting my hair short like Clara Bow, and that will be the end of that ritual, Juan Julian. I would offer to find a strong-looking tree, but the ritual won't count if it's not done on February 3rd. Conchita, I believe everything counts if you have faith, Juan Julian. So are you telling me that I should pick a strong-looking tree? Conchita, yes, if you wish, Juan Julian. And why me? Conchita, because you offer to, and you are the reader of the love stories, and anybody who dedicates his life to reading books believes in rescuing things from oblivion, Juan Julian. So is there a story in your hair, Conchita? There will be the day I cut it, and that story will come to an end, Juan Julian. And how does one read the story of your hair, Conchita? The same way one reads a face or a book, Juan Julian. Then we shouldn't bury your hair under a tree. We should place it inside a manuscript the same way Victorian women used to press flowers or a lock of hair between the pages of a book. Conchita, then I would leave it to you to choose the book. Juan Julian, how about this one? Conchita, my hair would be in good company with Anna Karenina. Juan Julian, then close your eyes and choose a page. She closes her eyes. She opens the book and chooses a page. He reads. At first, Anna sincerely believed that she was annoyed with him for daring to pursue her. But very soon after her return from Moscow, when she went to an evening party where she thought she was going to meet him, but to which he did not come, she came to the realization by the sadness that overwhelmed her that she was deceiving herself. Conchita, then here, cut my hair.
Nilo Cruz, reading from the Pulitzer Prize-winning drama Anna in the Tropics. Nilo Cruz lives in New York City and teaches at Yale University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for this program.